This episode is brought to you by Fooley Gemstones. Hello, I'm Carol Walton, the voice of jewellery. Welcome to If Jewels Could Talk. We've just all watched the Oscars, the gowns, the actors who won and lost, and the jewellery, which is what I want to talk about today. Following on from our episode last week on why Hollywood loves diamonds, we're going to talk about the lasting impact and legacy of when certain actors wear certain jewels. I don't know about you, but for me, it wasn't a spectacular year. There were some nice looks. Charlize Theron, Emily Blunt, they wore high neck diamonds with long loose necklaces. So everyone's talking about layering diamonds as a new trend. But these were pieces that I felt were put together to make more of an impact because they were designs and necklaces that we've seen on other red carpets worn by other celebrities. I thought the men had the most interesting looks again with their brooches like last year. Coleman Domingo had a lovely David Yurman brooch tucked in the bow tie of his tuxedo. John Krasinski had a great Schlumberger brooch, and I love to see a bit of antique on the red carpet. But unlike the golden age of Hollywood, the 30s or 40s, when pieces were made for actors and actresses and they reflected their loves, life and legacy in the jewellery, and especially when it came up for auction, because the provenance of the movies they'd worn them in, the stage of life they were at, who gave them to them, why they bought it, all had a knock-on effect of the intrinsic value of these pieces when they came under the hammer at auction. I felt that the only piece with that possibility this year was worn by Cillian Murphy, the Best Actor winner. He wore a gold brooch made by Bethrel Mack at Sauvignon, and it was a very nuanced gold, so there was a lot of complexity and depth. It was made of 8 concentric trapeziums, which reflected the shape of the interior components on Oppenheimer's history-changing invention. So not only was it made for Cillian to wear that night, but it also reflected the role he played in his Oscar-winning performance, Oppenheimer. So I think that's going to be very interesting to watch that in the future, what happens to that brooch and who lands up wearing it, and if it was sold, what it would fetch at auction. And bearing that in mind, I want to talk today, there's no one better to talk about this with than Frank Everett, of the head of jewellery at Sotheby's America, on the impact at auction on pieces owned and worn in Hollywood. Frank, thank you for squeezing us in on your hectic trip to London.
This is the highlight of my week, Carol. It is my pleasure to be here. We've talked about doing this for such a long time, and I'm glad it worked out. It's perfect. Yeah. Perfect end to the week.
And we both love talking about Hollywood jewellery, so we thought we'd do it on the podcast. Because more than any film role, husband, lover, or studio mogul, it was jewellery that actually played the permanent starring role in many stars' life during the golden age of Hollywood. Amassing a glittering jewellery collection was synonymous with high glamour and celebrity, and was actually considered part of the job of a star. When she was bedecked in gems, she broke through the illusion of film, bringing our fantasies to life, resonating with the dreams and imaginations of moviegoers. And these stars, in effect, fell under the same spell, using the jewels to reinforce their own fiction. Unlike modern actresses, they flaunted extravagant jewels in at-home style spreads in new magazines such as Coronet or Movie Star Parade in a way that we just couldn't begin to imagine now. And so I wanted to talk with Frank about why they did this and how effective it was and the role that jewels took themselves starring in movies, and how it resonates now at auction in some of these pieces.
Yeah.
So Frank, I mean, do jewels that stars have worn have a premium at auction?
They certainly do, whether they were worn in a film or whether they were just in the personal collection of a great actress. There's so many different areas of Hollywood jewels to discuss, because you do have, of course, maybe a jewel plays an integral part in the plot, or maybe it's just beautiful jewels setting the scene and the tone of the character, or maybe it's the woman herself, the actress herself, and the jewels that she collected, as they did. And some of the most magnificent collections of the 20th century belong to women in Hollywood. We don't see them collecting that way so much anymore, sadly.
So these were women like Merle Oberon, Ava Gardner, Joan Crawford.
Paulette Goddard. I have to start with her only because it's the most recent jewel that I've had the privilege to sell at Sotheby's just this past season. Uh-huh. We had a remarkable cuff bracelet from the 1930s made by Paul Flato, who was kind of known to be jeweler to the Hollywood stars. And this bracelet had such an interesting story because Paulette Goddard was not only in the running, but the favorite candidate to play Scarlett O'Hara.
In Gone with the Wind.
In the 30s, late 30s. The film was 1939. So much was she favored, she was the only actress given a color screen test. So she kind of thought she had it in the bag.
Was this when she was married to Charlie Chaplin?
Correct. Mm-hmm. She was married to Charlie Chaplin. At the last moment, the role went to Vivian Leigh, of course. And so as a little bit of a consolation gift, Charlie Chaplin gave her this beautiful emerald and diamond and gold cuff. Big flowers made with cabochon emeralds and diamonds, and just a wonderful piece of jewelry. She treasured it. She wore it often. She actually wore it in the film The Women when she was in that movie. And this was sold with her estate years ago and just came back to auction this year. So brought a tremendous price.
What was it?
I think it was probably about four or five times the estimate. I think it was in for around 30 to 50,000 and sold for about 200,000.
Wow.
Really, because of the story. Yes, it was a wonderful jewel, mm-hmm. great piece of jewelry, but the story is what sold it.
The story. And so do you think that the actual actress and her life or the movie has more impact on the sale price?
I think maybe her life, because it was so interesting. You know, she really had a reputation for being quite an outspoken, kind of sassy, energetic person. And she did have a lot of great jewelry. This was not just a one-off thing. He knew what he was doing when he bought her that bracelet because she loved jewels and she had a great collection. So I think it was really more about the woman and the personal style than it was actually having been worn in the film.
I read somewhere that there was a model, a Chanel model on a flight going from Paris to Geneva, who was sitting quite near Paulette Goddard. And she was kind of amazed when she took out a cigar tin, which had six wide diamond bracelets in, and she began to clean them with an airline cloth and just sort of brushed them up. And apparently Edith Head, the fashion designer, said she'd come on set with her cigar case of jewelry.
Yeah.
And it didn't matter what film she was in, she'd want to wear them on set.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, there was a film in 1945, a period movie, Kitty, and she was meant to be in a big Gainsborough style, you know, sort of 18th century dress.
Right.
But she wore her modern jewelry.
She wore deco jewelry, right, from the 20s, 30s. Why not?
I mean, she loved them, and she had this fringe necklace of 50 diamonds and said, I got the necklace because I got engaged so many times and I never gave the diamonds back. So these women knew what they were doing, didn't they?
They did. I mean, to me, the most famous example of a woman wearing her own pieces on screen would be Gloria Swanson and her famous Cartier bangles, the beautiful rock crystal and diamond ones, I believe designed by Jean Toussaint. And these were her favorite jewels worn in Sunset Boulevard, which, of course, was kind of a art imitating life, you know.
At silent. The end of her career, fading beauty, one of her last big starring roles.
Exactly. And she wore those cuffs. And one of the greatest photographs of Hollywood ever is seeing Gloria Swanson at the Oscars. She's been nominated for Sunset Boulevard, and she's just sort of sitting there biting her nails with those magnificent bracelets on her wrist. And they are so special, so unusual, and of course are now back in the Cartier archive where they belong. So it's great to see that the houses do buy those pieces back. But She knew what she was doing too, and she wore them in another film. I can't remember which one it was, but she's worn them more than once.
She really aligned her image, didn't she, with glamour? And I think she was the one who said the public wanted us to live like kings and queens, so we did.
Yeah.
But of course, they had to have a lot of money to do this. And I think it was Photoplay that reported her the annual figures of her spending, which was in 1924, something like $5,000 on silk stockings, $5,000 on perfume, $5,000 on lingerie, but gowns, $25,000, but a whopping $50,000 on jewelry. And she had to accessorize each outfit with different jewelry, and to make sure she had different jewelry, to accessorize each outfit. Often she loaned them, and she had loaned them for 10% of the cost of the price, which, you know, spending £500,000 on loaning meant she was sort of wearing $5 million of jewelry.
Yeah.
And the magazines dubbed her a clothes horse, but she said, "It happens to be true. I have to work like a horse to have these clothes."
Exactly. You know, there's a wonderful video in the Chanel exhibition at the V&A right now. I just went yesterday. Uh-huh. And there's a video of her in a film, all Chanel clothing. All the costumes were done by Coco Chanel. Lots of jewels. Can't tell what's real, what's not real, if it's hers. But it really captures that idea that at that time, especially between the wars, they created a complete image of fantasy, where the clothes and the furs and the jewels were so fabulous and over the top at any moment of the day these characters were living. And I think that's what people wanted. They wanted to see glamour, almost an unreal version of glamour. And that's what they gave.
And this was the time of the Depression. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be the harder the Depression, the more people went to the movies and the more these stars emerged like sort of royalty wherever they went. And
exactly.
I just thought, you know, we're living through pretty stark times right now. But we seem to be the opposite. The more we're plunged into global difficulties and economic crisis, we're keeping away from the movies.
I'm surprised, too. It doesn't make sense to me that escapist quality is... I think that was a very important element of film at that time. Everybody could... Or not everybody, but people could save and at least buy the, you know, for the price of a ticket and then go for 2 hours, kind of have a break from the reality. And that's what those glamour cats provided.
The magic.
Yeah. I was looking. I can't remember the name of the film. That she did, but I haven't seen it, and now I want to see it.
What, Glorious Swanson?
Yes, the one where Chanel did all the costumes, and it was just so beautiful. The clips that they put together in this video and in the exhibition was wonderful.
Because Chanel had a bit of a flirtation with Hollywood, not long.
Not long.
No, I think, you know, she arrived with great fanfare by railroad, didn't she? And crowds came to greet her. But I think she was too hardworking and she didn't get the movies, did she?
Yeah. No, it was not for her.
No, not for her. But many of the jewels they bought, as we said, landed up in the movies. And the jewelers publicized themselves as well, lending jewels in return for a screen credit. Mm-hmm. So it was big business for them.
Absolutely. I remember my first introduction to the jewelry of David Webb was at a wonderful exhibition at the Norton Museum in Palm Beach. And they had an entire room devoted to Webb's jewels on film, mostly Lana Turner. She was a big fan and wore all of his jewelry in several films. But David Webb had a rich history in the late 50s into the 60s of making jewelry, lending jewelry for film. And many others as well. Joan Crawford famously wore lots of Yard jewelry.
Raymond Yard.
Mm-hmm. On film. Her, you know, the jewels from that period that we most associate with Joan Crawford, we say this all the time, that sort of retro look, big citrines, big aquamarines set in that high polished gold. That's the Joan Crawford look, even though everybody was wearing it at the time. But because she wore those things so famously on film, I do at least always just associate that look with Joan.
Yes. And Marlene Dietrich had a couple, didn't she?
Oh, yes.
She had a couple of mega stones.
Mega bracelets. I have two bracelets that we've worked with from her collection. And I have to say, her image, her style is truly timeless. We use that word a lot, words like timeless and iconic. But there is something about Marlene Dietrich's personal style, because she was so modern in her day, that resonates 100 years later with young people. I think her provenance still holds value. So at Sotheby's, I would say maybe 6 or 7 years ago, a bracelet came to us that had been in her personal collection. Gold link bracelet, tricolor gold by Cartier, with a sort of barrel of lapis as the clasp. So this is a bracelet that would come, it was late 30s, you would maybe expect it to bring $15,000 to $20,000 if it were not hers, but that provenance lifted it to about $250,000.
Oh my God.
Not only did it come from her collection, but it had a wonderful story. It was a gift to her from the author Eric Maria Remarque, who wrote All Quiet on the Western Front. They had a love affair and then a friendship, and she was instrumental in getting him out of Europe during the war. And this bracelet was a gift from him that she wore time and time again in her personal life. There are many pictures of her wearing it. And to think in the, you know, at that time, such a modern, chunky piece of jewelry, it was really ahead of its time design-wise, you know, compared to what everybody else was wearing. And then, of course, recently, her Van Cleef & Arpels ruby bracelet was just sold again.
The mystery set.
Yeah. And that is a remarkable piece. I think that's 1939 as well, if I'm not mistaken. So the first time it was sold through Sotheby's from her estate, it now was just sold again at Christie's. And I think brought about $4.5 million.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That is, I mean, it's the weird thing is that these jewels outlasted and outpaid any paycheck they have had in their lifetime.
Or real estate or stocks or anything else, right?
I mean, there's a lovely story when Ava Gardner was in her 60s and she was writing her autobiography. And one journalist said to her, "Why are you writing your, why have you chosen to write your story now?" And she said, "Honey, I'm broke. And it's either the jewels or write a book. And I'm kind of fond of the jewels." So she wanted to write the book and keep the jewels.
And keep the jewelry. And she also had a beautiful collection.
She did, didn't
she? Yeah, so it's interesting, too, that they, the, even if they couldn't have always afforded the jewels, they put a priority on it, you know? They really thought that this was important for them to acquire and collect.
Well, I think when Marlene Dietrich had, she had a big one by Trebethofer and Maubuisson, a big one by Flato, these huge cuffs with important gemstones. I think it sort of announced her arrival as a major movie star.
I think so too. I think so too. She did like that big bracelet. And the ruby, Van Cleef & Arpels, she did wear in two films. Stage Fright, for sure she wore it. And I think she wore it in one other film as well. So again, you know, bringing your own personal style and taste into the character, which I don't know if that's happening so much anymore.
And Flato, as you said, the LA jeweler, he moved to LA particularly to target the movies and movie stars, didn't he?
He sure did.
And he made these kind of whimsical, surreal designs they couldn't find anywhere else.
Right. Yeah. No, he, and he, I'm sure, was a very smart businessman and gave good, if not gave away the pieces, at least gave good prices to big name stars so that they would hopefully wear them and kind of be a billboard for him. Of course, it wasn't until the 40s that somebody, you know, Winston actually lent jewelry for the Oscars. That was sort of the, maybe the beginning of the end. I don't know.
When he lent it to Jennifer Jones.
Jennifer Jones, exactly.
And that was what movie?
I can't remember. She was nominated for something that year.
I think
year.
It was Song for Bernadette.
That's right. That's right. Did she win? I think she might have won, actually.
I think she might have won.
And she was married to David O. Selznick at the time.
The producer.
Huge producer. And I don't know the details of how it came about, but she borrowed diamonds from Harry Winston, and that was sort of the beginning of it all. Now, Winston, of course, was a master marketer. He was a genius, and his court of jewels, you know, traveling from city to city in the U.S. and using all the local socialite ladies to model jewels in the evening. Like he knew what he was doing, and I'm sure in each town, one or two of those pieces would have been purchased by some of the ladies of the city. So he very much invented that kind of lending library.
There's an anecdote in his son's book, The King of Diamonds, about how the very first stone he bought, the very first huge important stone, the Yonker, before it had been cut, and it was 726 carats, yeah. His first big deal. And I think he paid something like £500,000 for it, which in those days must have been like a fortune.
A fortune.
And obviously he was panicking about, you know, what do I do? How do I offload the stone? How do I get some money back? Probably had, you know, bankers at his heels. And so he staged a publicity stunt and had the stone, had Shirley Temple, who was then the sweetheart of America in the movies, holding the jewel. And hope that would lead to a buyer. Mm-hmm. So he, as you said, he really knew how to market his jewels around the movies.
He sure did.
And I think Flato got to a point where I think, you know, some of his witty designs, I mean, he did sign language and gestures and telephones and envelopes and things that people really hadn't done.
Yeah.
But I think it got to the point where the movies provided inspiration for his designs.
I think that could be true. Yeah, I think he was so closely allied with Hollywood. He must have been sort of keeping up with the times in terms of his designs to stay appealing because they wanted new. I mean, everybody always wanted to look new and fresh.
There was one gold digger bracelet that I thought was kind of cute that had golden charms representing objects of the miners' trade. And I guess, you know, California, the great gold rush.
Yeah.
And there was diggers and pickaxes and a little gold nugget and something you pan for gold. And apparently that was all inspired by Busley Berkeley and his gold digger movie.
I've never seen that bracelet.
And I wondered, so many actresses at the time, they literally wore their life or told their life through some of the charms or jewels or medallions that they had inscribed that were important to them. Ginger Rogers had a beautiful charm bracelet. Of course, Elizabeth Taylor, but anyone listening, we did devote an entire special to Elizabeth Taylor at the end of last season. So if you want to know more about that, go back to that episode.
Yes, that's a whole story in itself. There are many, many stories. You know, that's one of my favorite books, in fact, My Love Affair with Jewelry,
yes.
Just because of the personal stories about each and every piece.
Yes.
But it's funny you bring up the inscriptions. For one thing, it's harder and harder to find people that do beautiful hand engraving, at least in New York. You know, it used to be easier to do. So now when clients want that, it's a bit of a challenge to find people that do that work. And decades ago, you didn't give a gift without engraving something on the back, at least, you know, from, you know, X to Y with the initials or the date or something. And then lots of people were known for doing very thoughtful messages and remembrances on the backs of jewels and cigarette cases in particular. It makes me think of Linda Porter, Cole Porter's wife, Linda Lee Thompson, and great jewelry collector, great Cartier client in particular, but she marked the opening of every show with a beautiful Cartier cigarette case.
That her husband had written.
Always. And she gave Cole Porter these pieces, and they had the name of the show and the date and some thoughtful message, some inscription. So those do come to auction. There were a lot of them. There were a lot of those gifts, and they always bring really, really great prices. She was portrayed in a film because she was such a wonderful jewelry collector. She had beautiful things. In fact, one of her early quotes was, she said, "My favorite department store is Van Cleef & Arpels." One department, jewelry. That's all she needed. But she is portrayed in this film called De Lovely. Have you ever seen the film De Lovely with Ashley Judd?
Yeah, and I think Armani did all the clothes.
Yes,
didn't he?
Exactly. He did. And the scene where he first sees her, she's wearing these marvelous three strands of pearls. Each one has a big Baroque drop, and she's got three lengths on. So it's just, you can't miss them. And at the end of the film, she's passed away, and he's an old man now at the piano by himself. And she sort of appears in a vision, and of course, she's wearing those pearls. And I just think it's such a powerful moment that this is how he remembered her, the first way he saw her. And the jewels were absolutely part of setting the tone and creating the character of Linda Porter. So I like when jewelry is used that way in a film, not just to adorn, not just to look beautiful, but to maybe set a tone or really say something about a character.
Yeah, I read somewhere talking about lovely inscriptions that one of Joan Crawford's husbands, and we can't be too accurate because they all got through quite a few husbands.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure which one it was, but he gave her a beautiful watch, and on the back he put something like, "I just love every second with you."
Yeah.
Something like that. It just really elevates a gift.
It does, and it's amazing how rarely people do it these days. Mm. They just don't think to do it, or it's just not not part of the gift, I guess. Mm. I don't know.
And another one we haven't talked about was Merle Oberon, who I think really was known as much for her jewels as her roles as an actress.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the famous emerald necklace.
Cartier
mm-hmm. necklace is the crown jewel of her collection, but she had beautiful things. And I'm not sure if she bought them for herself or if they were gifts or probably a little bit of both. How many husbands did she have?
She had Alexander Korda, the big producer, didn't she?
Of course.
And I think that she had, because she had so much from Cartier, that she commissioned a pigskin case to be made to travel with 28 compartments just for traveling. And she'd have 5 necklaces, 6 bracelets, 11 rings. And she particularly liked Cartier jewels because she could take them apart and put them in all her pigskin velvet-lined or silk-lined compartments, just for traveling. But when she married Alexander Korda, he gave her 3 Cartier roses and diamonds, which she wore in the film Till We Meet Again in 1940, and happily talked to reporters afterwards about the sentimental value of the jewels she'd worn in the film. Now, that's something we can't imagine today, can we?
No. Actresses today are so used to wearing something once, so it has almost no personal attachment, even if it's something that they might have chosen from the jeweler to wear. It's done by stylists. It's a different business. It's a really different business because it is used as marketing, of course. But the deals that are made are for the brands and for the actresses as well. But I just I don't think they ever intend on wearing anything more than once.
No, and then it's loaned.
Yeah,
and then it's given back.
How is something ever going to become your signature piece? The way of Marlene Dietrich would have had that lapis bracelet just worn very casually with a suit or something during the day. That to me, that's one of the beautiful things about a piece of jewelry, when you really wear it in so many ways on so many different occasions, it just becomes kind of an extension of you. And I don't see that happening too much with anybody in Hollywood today.
And I guess it was very aspirational at the time.
Yeah.
People watched what they wore in the movies to try and emulate them in real life, whether it was costume. Mm-hmm. I mean, it had such an impact in America, didn't it, at that time, that, you know, department stores were opening up, women were buying costume jewels to look like the movie stars. But I think what do you think the last trend that came from a star wearing a jewel was?
Good question.
I mean, there was the Carrie necklace on television.
Yes.
And that really had a global impact, I think.
It did. I think that's true. Of course, you know, Jennifer Lopez did set off the pink diamond craze.
Not too many women can get a pink diamond.
Yeah. Years ago. Now she's moved on to green. but yeah, I think maybe that you're right. The Carrie necklace and that, you know, that name necklace was so popular in the 70s. I can remember, you know, lots of young women wearing it, and then she brought it back. So that would probably be the most recent one that I could think of.
Mm.
Think of what else? I mean, jewelry, I don't feel like there's ever been a film that really captured the spirit of jewelry the way we love it. You know, sometimes a jewel will play a part in a plot, even when there's a theft. But I don't feel like anybody's ever really captured the spirit of, you know, the design and the history of a house. Has there ever been a film about one of the great jewelers, for instance, the Cartier family, right? We've read the book, The Cartiers.
And
it's such a fascinating story. Why doesn't somebody make that a movie, you know, about the industry?
I think that book is optioned. I think you'll find it's optioned, because I was in LA recently and met up with Francesca Cartier, who's written the book about her family, and I think it's optioned. So hopefully it will be made.
I can't wait to see it.
And at some point we'll get her on to talk about that.
Fabulous.
So no actresses now are known for amassing a collection, are they? And if they do, they're probably rather secret about it.
They are. They are quite secret about it. I do. I had a nice story a few years ago with the actress Jennifer Tilly, who loves jewelry. And she acquired a set made by Paul Flato. And what was so nice about it, of course, it's a beautiful set. It's sort of a Y necklace with a matching bracelet with lots of leaves and bows and diamonds and gold. It's really a wonderful piece. But it belonged originally to the actress Norma Shearer.
So it's got a double acting provenance.
It's got a double acting provenance. Both Canadian actresses, so I think that was interesting to her. And then, of course, Norma Shearer was the star of the film The Women, in which many of those actresses wore their own jewels, Joan Crawford and Paulette Goddard. And then Jennifer Tilly herself was in the Broadway production of The Women. So I think she felt that connection in
a strong connection
several
in
ways.
Every single way.
She loves Flato, also Canadian, in The Women, and it was just a beautiful jewel. So I think that's a very special part of her collection. It was really a privilege to work with her and have her acquire that one. It's just a wonderful, wonderful piece of jewelry and a great story.
I think, have you sold pieces to Barbara Streisand?
If I think about jewelry on film, to me, the greatest performance by a jewel ever is the Deco pearl earrings that she wears at the end of Funny Girl. And she must agree because she chose that image for the cover of her new book.
Which just came out.
So these earrings, if you remember the last scene where she, Fanny Brice comes out and sings My Man against a black background and a black dress. So really all you see is her head sort of floating on this dark stage. And the earrings really help create the emotion as she's singing this song. And, you know, it's breaking her heart. But without those earrings, the scene would not be the same. And those earrings, I know, were her own from her own collection. She eventually lost them. She said she left them in the pocket of a coat
on
set.
Oh, my God.
And they disappeared. So sadly, they're gone. I'm not sure if they were signed or not, but they're just wonderful diamond drop earrings with a little pearl, a teardrop pearl at the end, and just beautiful. But if you go watch that scene again, you'll see what I mean. Without those earrings, it's not the same scene.
And she loves particularly Art Deco jewelry.
Correct.
So she goes around the auction houses and looks.
Yeah.
And I know she's been to Paris to the great Jarre.
Mm.
And apparently the story goes that she was wandering through the Place Vendôme and Joe Rosenthal happened to be out of his studio. And so she looked up and said, "Are you Joel?" And he said, "I'm Joel if you're Barbara." And in she went. So I don't know whether she's got any Jarre, but she probably has.
Yeah.
I'm in quite a few actresses' head off there now. I know that. Other than that, they tend to, Gwyneth Paltrow's father, Bruce Paltrow, bought the Harry Winston necklace she wore when she won her Oscar.
Yes, that beautiful princess necklace, which was just perfect for her at the time. And we loved that story. We loved when she, because this was already the time when everybody was borrowing. Mm. And I thought it was a great thing to have him purchase that necklace for her, because it will have meaning for the rest of her life. Mm. You know, she'll, every time she wears it, not just because of her Oscar, but of course, because of her father. So we like to see when that happens. It doesn't happen as often as it should. But it'd be interesting to see what was worn to the Oscars coming up. I was just remembering some earrings that Solange Azzaguri made that Julianne Moore wore to the Oscars years ago.
When she was working for Boucheron.
Yes. And to me, those are iconic. Mm. That was one of the first times we saw colored stones in that black gold, no diamonds, and just so striking with Julianne Moore's red hair. And that was a really great moment, I think, on the red carpet. And I'm hoping we see some more. Some seasons, it seems like everybody plays it very safe. You know.
I think when the world is turbulent, they play it very safe because they don't want to look as if they're not respectful to what some people are going through, don't you think?
I think so. I miss the days of Cher showing up.
Oh,
with a big...
Me too. I mean, God, you and the mistakes people made.
Oh, yeah.
Now everyone's just so careful and they all look the same.
Yeah.
And they all have, you know, the same off-the-shoulder Dior gown that looks like a Dior, even if it's not, the little ear diamond safe look.
Yeah.
And we want people to look how they look. And if they make a mistake 1 year, fine. Or not a mistake, but they wear something that isn't adhering to the play it safe look.
Exactly. I can remember Diane Keaton going to the Oscars in kind of full Annie Hall regalia, but with some black lace gloves. And I mean, in some ways, it was a mess, but in other ways, it was fabulous. Mm. You know, this really was a reflection of her style, the character style, the time, and that's how she wanted to present herself. No one told her how to dress. She chose it.
Yeah. And it's obvious when someone has some of their own personal style. And these actresses should take note of history in a way, because the first Oscars came and went and no one really took much notice. It was the second Oscars when Mary Pickford arrived to get her Best Actress statuette wearing glittering diamonds that her film Coquette had a boost at the box office. So it was aligning herself as this glamorous movie star that boosted her film.
Yeah.
So they should take note of that.
They really should. I'm all for glamour, but sometimes it doesn't have to be so safe. Mm. And it is nice to see a little reflection of somebody's personal style and wear something of their own. But I don't know who owns jewelry.
We loved it when Salma Hayek wore a tiara.
Yes.
And obviously Elizabeth Taylor. We love that. You know, they're...
And I love when somebody wears 19th century jewels. It still happens. You do see Fred Layton on the carpet quite often. Meryl Streep wears Fred Layton. Even Sarah Jessica Parker has often worn Fred Layton jewels, and she'll wear some, you know, 19th century brooches up her white glove or as a hair ornament. So I'm always a champion of antique things when they show up on the red carpet. It's not as often as I'd like, but it does happen.
And also stylists go and look at younger designers who are doing great things and give one of them a shot and a boost.
Yeah.
That would be good, wouldn't it?
Yes. The singer Dua Lipa just wore a vintage Tiffany piece to, I think, maybe the Golden Globes. And it was wonderful with citrine and gold and not the kind of typical thing that you're seeing on the red carpet. And it looked wonderful.
And maybe she'll be paid to wear that, wouldn't
probably.
She?
Probably.
I think so. You know, that's the trouble, that they turn down all these young designers. They say, sorry, I get paid.
Yeah.
And so there's a whole kind of thing that, a platform that is denied to up-and-coming designers.
Yeah. I do think you see a little more risk-taking sort of at the Grammys from the music crowd.
I agree. The music crowd are much better.
And they'll take a chance and they'll wear more contemporary things or as you say, like a young up-and-coming designer or somebody who's a little bit more niche. And I love that. I do love to see those designs at the Grammys. So that's a fun one.
So the bond between Hollywood-loving diamonds, is it safe, do you think, Frank?
I would say... Yes, I think it's going to continue. There's no shortage of diamonds on the red carpet, that's for sure. And in film, on film, it's, you know, maybe the luxury won't stay so quiet. Maybe it'll get a little bit loud again, and we'll start to see a little bit more jewelry in film, creating characters and sort of setting the tone for some of the great ladies of style. We'll see.
We hope so. But Frank, thank you very much for joining us.
What a pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you, Carol.
And please join us on the website, carolwalton.com/podcast, because we'll put up images of what we've been speaking about. And we now have a YouTube channel. So join us there and you can listen into the podcasts and see more imagery and films and the back catalogue. Thanks so much for listening. Goodbye. If Jewels Could Talk with Carol Walton is produced by Natasha Cowan, music and editing by Tim Thornton, graphics by Scott Bentley, illustration by Jordi Labanda. You can find our sponsors at fullygemstones.com and me at carolwalton.com.